It's a great pleasure and an honour to be able to welcome Professor Bill Wallace, who is currently Barbara Murphy Bryant Distinguished Professor of Art History in the Department of Art History and Archaeology at Washington University at St. Louis. He has, of course, written prolifically on Michelangelo. Of the many eminent biographers of Michelangelo we have here today, I think nobody knows that record of the documentation for projects like San Lorenzo, which happened over very long periods, and the degree of understanding you have of his working relationships in order to make sense of and take forward our understanding of him, not just as a heroic artist, but as an entrepreneur. And Professor Wallace has written 7 books on Michelangelo, most recently his Michelangelo, the Artist and the Man, and his Times of 2010, talking also about Michelangelo's overriding ambitions for his family, as indeed for the social status of artists, which is, I think, crucial for understanding this question of quite what is being demonstrated in these anatomical figures. So I'm very happy to welcome you.
Thank you very much, Alison. Actually, what you don't know is I planted all those 4 questions that we just had. So thank you, Timothy. That was perfect, a perfect lead into my paper. I too, like all of you, I think when I first saw these bronzes, I was utterly fascinated and taken by their beauty. But their attribution to Michelangelo is, I suspect, will continue to generate debate. Somewhat less controversial is their subject matter, but now that we've raised it, that's exactly what I'd like to talk to you about today. Although the meaning of two men riding on two nude men riding on large felines is certainly unusual, if not unique, in Renaissance iconography. In this talk, I'd like to consider the subject matter and the meaning of the bronzes, which in turn permits us to better determine why and when they might have been made, and as well, lending some evidence to the thornier question of for whom they were made and by whom they were made. My talk is inspired by a brilliant insight by a graduate student at Washington University, Meg Galindo, who unfortunately for health reasons was unable to be here today. Shortly after the bronzes went on display, Meg came to my office and in a burst of excitement blurted out, "I think they are Harmodius and Aristogeiton." Like some of you, I looked a bit blank. Before she added the tyrannicides of ancient Athens. And that was the moment the scales fell from my eyes. So this is the story of that fateful pair of heroes. In 514 BCE, the male lovers, Harmodius and Aristogeiton, hatched a plot to assassinate the 2 sons of Pisistratus and liberate the city of Athens from their tyrannical rule. The grateful Athenians erected a pair of statues in bronze, representing Harmodius and Aristogeiton, and placed them in the Agora. The first, and for a very long time, the only such statues of human beings in that very special place. These 2 men, one older and one younger, were lovers who sacrificed themselves in the cause of liberty. For the Athenians, they were the supreme exemplar of political action, and a constant reminder of the threat posed by tyrants to a fragile democracy. Along with Brutus, the slayer of Julius Caesar, the tyrannicides are the oldest and the most eloquent symbol of tyranny overthrown. The story of Harmodius and Aristogeiton is most fully told by Thucydides in its history of the Peloponnesian Wars. Thucydides was known to the Renaissance thanks to the great humanist orator, Lorenzo Valla, who translated the Greek into more accessible and widely accessible Latin in the mid-15th century. Of all the literary sources, however, the best known, especially to Renaissance artists, was the description of the tyrannicides found in Pliny the Elder's Natural History, where the famous group is mentioned 3 different times in Book 34, which comprises a history of ancient bronze sculpture. Pliny celebrated the statues as symbols of democracy, emphasizing their unique character. quote, the ancients did not make any statues of individuals unless they deserved immortality. Therefore, the Athenians were introducing a new custom when they set up statues at public expense in honor of Harmodius and Aristogiton, who killed the tyrants. Pliny's description of the tyrannicide served as the basis for their mention, the mention of these statues that we find, for example, in Lorenzo Ghiberti's commentary, as well as Leon Battista Alberti's treatise on architecture. Thus, Renaissance humanists and artists were well aware of the ancient statue group and the significance of the deed which it commemorated. Boccaccio, for example, mentions the tyrannicides as young nobles driven to kill the cruel tyrant in an entirely unexpected place in his very popular work on famous women. And Machiavelli mentions them in passing in his discourses on Livy. In addition to their celebration in ancient and contemporary Renaissance literature, the statues were preserved in several Roman marble copies, the best known of which is this much restored group now in Naples. However, in the early 16th century, these two figures were unrestored marble fragments found in the courtyard of the Palazzo Medici Madama in Rome, seen in this drawing by Martin van Heemskerk. Here, we see one forcefully striding figure without head or arms, and the other tyrannicide is the more fragmentary torso in the rear corner. In a second drawing by Heemskerk of the same Medici Madama courtyard, but from a different viewpoint, we see the better preserved striding figure at the left, as well as the more fragmentary torso in the corner, without head, arms, or lower legs. Despite the fragmentary state of the two statues, Renaissance writers and artists were especially drawn to the extreme and dramatic spread of the legs, which characterizes both figures. For example, the great antiquarian Ulisse Aldrovandi wrote admiringly of the figure on your left, a very beautiful statue on a marble base with wide open legs, con un atto di gambe sforzato. But how would a Renaissance artist reconstruct a full figure from such battered fragments? A parallel example is offered by Michelangelo, who was inspired by the highly incomplete torso Belvedere on your left to give new life to a whole series of the Sistine Ignudi. As Howard Hibbard astutely observed, the Ignudi are 20 different reconstructions of the ancient torso. A similar challenge, therefore, is posed by the fragmentary statue of the Roman marble group, copies of the famous tyrannicide group from ancient Athens in bronze. What could a Renaissance artist make of such fragments? Let us examine the ancient torso on your left and compare it to the Rothschild bronze on your right, here seen removed from the separately cast feline on which it normally sits. The ancient torso, even in fragmentary state, provides enough information to determine that the right arm was raised. Whoops, yes. And the left arm lowered, just as we see in the ancient, as we see in the bronze figure. Noting the spread of the torso's legs, but uncertain of the exact disposition of the lower limbs, our Renaissance artist has reconstructed the legs in a manner that suggests the figure was straddling something. The younger man is a similar reconstruction with raised arm and bent legs, yet in mirror image, possibly with reference to yet another famous fragmentary antiquity, the torso Belvedere. This is the moment, hypothetical of course, that I imagine our Renaissance artists not merely generating complete figures from ancient fragments, but also recognizing these ancient statues to have originally constituted parts of the famous tyrannicide group. And that is what the artist of the Rothschild bronzes has created. a powerful, if imaginative, reconstruction of one of the most famous ancient statuary groups from the ancient world. And a closer look at the Rothschild bronzes helps us support this hypothesis. For me, the most important aspects for determining the iconography and meaning of the figures are their emphatic gestures, their fierce countenances, and the significance of them being a pair. The raised arms are declamatory gestures of defiance, determination, and triumph. Both figures clutch cylindrical objects that are probably the handles of weapons, likely the daggers used by Harmodius and Aristogiton to bring down the Athenian tyrant. Given the relative social position and responsibility of the two figures, the older, bearded Aristogiton is appropriately right-handed. He forcefully thrusts his right arm and tensely clutches what was, most likely, a downward-pointing dagger, here reconstructed as the more threatening gesture of the dominant male nude. The younger Harmodius, described by Thucydides as a most beautiful young man, raises his left arm and more lightly grips what was likely an upward-pointing dagger. Death and triumph described in these similar but subtly contrasting gestures. The upthrust arm has been an emblem of triumph since time immemorial. A well-known example that is close in spirit to the Rothschild bronzes is Benvenuto Cellini's Perseus, holding aloft the head of a tyrannical Medusa. For me, these emphatic gestures of triumph are a key to a proper understanding of the Rothschild bronzes, gestures that are reinforced by the fierce countenances of our two protagonists. These are serious, determined individuals dedicated to sacrificing their lives for the greater good of a free society. While their set features and furrowed brows suggest their determination, there is also a suggestion of why they undertook the dangerous deed, which, however, depends on the two of them looking at one another in an arrangement opposite of how they're exhibited in the museum. If we switch their positions with the older, bearded Aristogiton appropriately on the dominant right side with an upraised right arm, he looks across his shoulder to the younger, beardless Harmodius, reminding us that the two men were lovers as well as heroes. The Renaissance was familiar with a number of famous male lovers, including Achilles and Patroclus, Alexander and Hephaestion, Hadrian and Antinous. While somewhat less known, the tyrannicides, Harmodius and Aristogiton, would have had a special appeal, not only because of their homoerotic relationship, but also, and more importantly, because of their dedication to a noble cause. There were few topics that more concerned Italian writers of the 15th and 16th century than the nature of good government, with tyranny being the worst form, and a republic, modeled on ancient Athens and republican Rome, representing the ideal. While these philosophical speculations spawned a huge literature, a more immediate concern was the constant threat posed by changes of government, which frequently resulted in retributive vengeance and exile. The Rothschild bronzes make a lot of sense when we see them against the backdrop of an exceptionally tumultuous period in Italian political history, especially in Florence. The expulsion of the Medici in 1494, the burning of Savonarola in 1498, the brutal sack of Prato in 1512, the conspiracy against the Medici in 1513, and the demise of the last republic in 1530 were all disruptive events seared into the citizens' memory. For Florentines, whether living in Florence under the Medici or in exile in the large expatriate communities of Rome and Naples, there was a persistent and fervent hope that tyranny would be overthrown and a republic reinstated. The firebrand Dominican monk, Girolamo Savonarola, wrote and preached tirelessly against tyranny, with pointed allusions to the contemporary regime of the Medici. In a similar vein, the great historian Francesco Guicciardini wrote of the danger of tyranny and offered five reasons which justify the overthrow of a tyrant, his current example being the feckless Piero de' Medici. "So I repeat," wrote Guicciardini, "that whenever the government is not legitimate but has qualities of tyranny, whether violent or mild, one ought to seek another type of government." Considering such a context, there are many persons who might be reasonable candidates for commissioning the Rothschild bronzes, beginning with the Pazzi family, whose resentment of the Medici actually prompted them to act as tyrannicides in the conspiracy of 1478. Although their plot failed, the exiled Pazzi harbored a festering resentment against the Medici regime. But equally, we should consider many others. The Doni, one of Michelangelo's early patrons, but also the Strozzi, Soderini, and Ridolfi families, all of whom were sympathetic to Republican ideals and might be candidates for sponsoring a potent image of tyranny overthrown. And lastly, that connoisseur and early patron of Michelangelo, Lorenzo di Pier Francesco de' Medici, deserves serious consideration. Lorenzo was from the cadet branch of the Medici family and was known as Il Popolano because he stood with the people in opposition to the main branch of the Medici. He was associated with the Republican opposition group after the Medici expulsion in 1494 and harbored a deep-seated resentment against members of the main branch. You will have noted that I have left out of my discussion any mention of the animals so far, although I think we're going to hear in the next paper more about them. The two feline cats are the greatest impediment to the suggestion of the subject matter that I have advanced here. But somewhat less so if we consider that the two male figures are the primary subject matter, and if we recognize the creative relationship of the Renaissance, the Renaissance had with classical antiquity. The current identification of the Rothschild bronzes as bacchantes, that is, followers of Bacchus, rests in part on the animals, which accompanying Bacchus and Bacchic revelry might naturally be panthers. But as Paul Joannides and Vicky Avery have generously admitted, the identity of these cats as panthers rests primarily on the assumption that the figures are Bacchic revelers. Having consulted several of my anthropological colleagues knowledgeable about big cats, I am fairly confident that these creatures belong to no obvious species. Indeed, they are composite beasts, as is typical of many animals represented by Renaissance artists who are only vaguely or indirectly interested in accurate biological representation. Ultimately, the identifications of the subject should depend less on the animals than on the more impressive aspect of these bronzes, the two male figures, which are more detailed and more anatomically correct than are the large cats. I also would like to reiterate the iconographic significance of them being a pair. To assume a Bacchic context is to accept that we are missing much of the expected iconography, as Timothy raised the issue, but we can also say there's no Bacchus, there's no Silenus, there's no Maenads. There's no suggestion that the felines are drawing a chariot, as we see, for example, in Titian's magnificent painting of Bacchus and Ariadne, although in this case, the two large cats are actually leopards. If instead we entertain the possibility that the bronzes represent the tyrannicides, then the iconography is complete. What we see is all we need to identify the subject and imagine why and for whom they might have been made. In the final analysis, the felines are as likely to be lionesses as panthers, which raises some interesting possibilities. In contrast to panthers, which were little known in Italy, lions and lionesses were well known. It might be significant that Florence retained live lions in the lower story of Palazzo Vecchio, and the street that ran in front of their caged window was named Via dei Leoni. Lions are ubiquitous in the art and iconography of Florence as one of the oldest and most venerated symbols of the Republic. One need only recall Donatello's Marzocco, which, like the ancient tyrannicide group, was the first, and for a very long time, the only statue erected in Piazza della Signoria, the counterpart to the Athenian agora. This was the favored symbol of an independent republican Florence, free of tyranny. By the time the Rothschild bronzes were designed and cast, Donatello's sculpture was old, and maybe its message had grown stale. In the face of perceived tyranny of an increasingly autocratic Medici, one can imagine a desire to rejuvenate an old symbol of the free republic. The objective of my talk has been to understand the subject matter and meaning of these exceptional and striking objects, and to speculate about why they would have been made in the first place. Along with my co-author, Meg Galindo, we think this pair of bronzes is an inventive recreation of a famous ancient sculpture group, and they were made not as mere decorative objects, but to convey a serious political message. The political turmoil of Renaissance Italy provides the context and incentive for commissioning such potent symbols of tyranny overthrown. Given a well-informed humanist and antiquarian culture, there are several candidates who might have commissioned such works. And finally, there are several artists, including Michelangelo, who deserves consideration, who might have been responsible for creating them. Yet the Rothschild bronzes do not need to be works of Michelangelo to command our interest and attention. The Rothschild bronzes are much more than a story about attribution. They are also a story of an artist's creative response to classical antiquity and that artist's ability to forge a unique and compelling works of art with a powerful and enduring political message. Thank you very much.